From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Four days left until Election Day. Bill Clinton will raise campaign finance reform today in California. We'll talk with a man who raises it every day.
Here's a test on whether you're growing up corporate. I'm going to give you three phrases. Crime, violence, welfare. Most people will think of street crime, poverty, welfare, and street violence. By far, in terms of destruction of property, health, safety, and welfare disbursements, there is far more corporate crime, corporate welfare, and corporate violence. It isn't even close.
We'll check in with Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader, a look at hot congressional races in Texas, and an analysis of how redistricting is affecting races throughout the South. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly half of all eligible voters, about 90 million Americans, probably won't go to the polls next Tuesday. The prediction comes from election expert Curtis Ganz, who expects turnout to drop from about 55% in 1992 to about 51% this year. Ganz heads the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. A political opponent of GOP Congressmember Jim Colby of Arizona, who admitted posting signs claiming the openly gay congressman has AIDS, took to the airwaves yesterday to repeat his allegations. Ed Finkelstein's broadcast broadside came less than 48 hours after he was questioned by police about the AIDS signs. Colby, who announced in July he's gay, condemned the AIDS allegation as a venomous lie. Finkelstein, listed on the ballot as a Reform Party candidate running against Colby for Arizona's 5th District seat, made a number of allegations during a rambling, hour-long free broadcast on radio station KTUC. The station owner said Finkelstein demanded equal time with other candidates under Federal Communications Commission law. Authorities determined the posters were a form of free speech and that there had been no criminal violations. The networks are saying they'll be announcing the election results early. Election officials in the western states are asking the networks to hold off declaring the winner in the presidential race while the polls are still open in the West on Tuesday night. Some western politicians have never forgiven Jimmy Carter for conceding to Ronald Reagan in 1980 while the polls were still open in California. They believe voters in droves decided not to cast ballots, thus turning the tide of some congressional races. President Clinton sums up his re-election case today with a speech in Santa Barbara, California, but aides say he'll also talk about campaign finances. Attorney General Janet Reno said today that the Justice Department had taken the first step toward deciding whether to seek an independent counsel to investigate possible wrongdoing by Democratic fundraisers. Although it doesn't guarantee such an appointment, the action provided the first official suggestion that complaints of possible crimes in the fundraising of millions of dollars by Democrats were serious enough to warrant full legal evaluation. Republican lawmakers, four House chair and two senators, John McCain of Arizona and Christopher Bond of Missouri, also asked the Justice Department to examine the fundraising activities of John Huang, senior official at the Democratic National Committee, who was suspended 2 weeks ago after reports questioned his work. He formerly was the president of the U.S. affiliate of the Lippo Group, an Indonesian conglomerate. President Clinton's advisors portray today's speech in California as a drawing together of what they call the big ideas of the Clinton campaign: the economy, welfare reform, education, strengthening families, and campaign finance reform. In addition to California, Clinton campaigns in Texas and New Mexico. Polls rate the Lone Star State as close. Clinton is hoping to be the first Democrat since Jimmy Carter to capture its 32 electoral votes. And Bob Dole has announced a nonstop 96-hour campaign tour beginning in Ohio today and ending at noon on Election Day in his hometown of Russell, Kansas. Dole says he'll be traveling from the industrial belt through the plains and across the Rocky Mountains. Dole told a campaign rally in Atlanta that he'll even stop in Las Vegas and roll the dice there. Meanwhile, Ross Perot has begun inundating TV viewers with 15-second spots airing nationally during primetime sporting events and on various cable shows. Perot, who for several months made only weekly public appearances, is attending a campaign rally daily now, hitting hard on President Clinton's ethics and the need for an outsider to reform the political system. Meanwhile, Vice President Al Gore talked about foreign policy while speaking in Melbourne, Florida, and praised Clinton for restoring democracy to Haiti with scarcely a shot being fired. Gore also talked about Clinton's steps to hasten the downfall of Fidel Castro. And an old-fashioned wanted ad appeared in a Texas newspaper recently, offering $1,000 reward for information about people who are not U.S. citizens trying to vote. Latino groups pointed to this and other such efforts yesterday as intimidation tactics aimed at scaring away newly naturalized citizens, some of whom may not understand the details of the most basic American right. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Over the past few days on Democracy Now!, we've invited you to call in on our listener comment line to share your thoughts about the elections. Tell us who you're planning to vote for and what issues you think are important. Here's a sampling of what we got yesterday.
Hello, my name is Victor McCrary, and I listen to Democracy Now! On WPSW in Washington, D.C. I'm voting for Mr. Clinton basically because I cannot vote for Mrs. Dole, since basically the Republican Party with nicotine is tantamount to being a drug dealer. And I think Mr. Clinton offers the best for African Americans.
Yes, I'm going to vote for Ralph Nader, and I'm encouraging everybody in my apartment complex to do the same. We recently, the building sold, and a whole bunch of new tenants moved in, and I got them registered to vote, and the polling place is going to be down in my complex. Before the voting day, I'm putting signs around for Nader, because I know he is the only one fighting the corporations, and he stands up for the rights of the people.
Yes, this is Martha Griswold in California, and it seems to me that one of the most important things in this election is to oppose Proposition 209, which trashes affirmative action. It seems to me very important that we not give up affirmative action for quite some long time to come, because it's clear that the playing field is not yet level.
I am going to vote for Ralph Nader, of course. He must get up to the 5% that's needed to get minority party status, plus he stands for everything a normal, reasonable human being would want.
Hello, I'm a supporter of Democracy Now!, and I unfortunately vote in Virginia, where Ralph Nader is not in the Green Party, not on the ballot. However, I will probably cast a protest vote.
My name is Fred. I'm from Houston. I live in Tom DeLay's precinct. He's one of the Republican leaders. I'm voting for President Clinton. A strong Clinton showing, or win here in Texas, will give progressives like me a boost. Then maybe we progressives can take the offensive and with progressive ideas like universal health care eventually. Thank you.
Hi, my name is David Moxon. I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. I just want to say that I think all these politicians are a bunch of corrupt scumbags, and I'm personally an anarchist. I'm going to vote anyway for Ted Kaczynski for president, because I think that he could, you know, figure out a lot of our problems. And as far as the Republicans and Democrats, they're basically the same party. You know, the whole plan is to completely wipe out all socialism in this country and, you know, turn everyone into obedient wage slaves. Thanks. You can put this on the air. Bye.
Yeah, this is Jeb Bennett calling from Boulder, Colorado, where I listen to KGNU radio. I appreciate your program. I'm voting for Nader this year, although the race is pretty close here in Colorado between the two major party candidates. I don't believe either of the major party candidates are talking about a lot of the issues that I'm concerned with. I'm also disappointed in Clinton's stance on the Defense of Marriage Act. Thank you.
And just some of the calls. We'll continue to play those calls throughout the week up to Election Day. You can give us a call about what you think is important in races in your state or in the presidential race, maybe an initiative that you're voting for, feel strongly about. Give us a call on our comment line at 202-588-0101. 0999 extension 313. That's 202-588-0999 extension 313. And speaking of Ralph Nader, clearly a favorite among the listeners who have called in so far over the last few days, we've got him on the phone right now. He's in Washington, D.C. Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
We are also joined by our Pacifica National Affairs correspondent, Larry Bensky, who is at our Pacifica station, KPFT, in Houston. Welcome, Larry.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, it's great to be with you both. Ralph, what are your plans for the next few days? We've just said that there's going to be a nonstop 96-hour campaign tour on the part of Dole. Clinton's going to New Mexico. He's in California. He's also going to be going to Arizona, I think. What about you? What are your plans?
Well, I'll be in Denver today at a news conference and then speak in Boulder, where you have one of your stations, and then on to California, and then back to the District of Columbia. This performance by Clinton seems to be getting worse and worse. He's now going to talk about campaign finance reform. He talked about campaign finance reform 4 years ago before he was elected. And in his inauguration address, he said he was going to change business as usual in Washington. Within a few weeks, he was selling a seat at the White House dinner table for a $100,000 contribution per person. He's the kind of politician about whom even friends have said can look you straight in the eye with the deepest of sincerity and lie.
I just want to correct something I said. I said he's going to Arizona. I think he's going to New Mexico and Texas. But what about campaign finance reform? He's going to make his proposal today. What do you think, Ralph Nader?
Well, the press has caught him. He's caught him with these scandals. And he's got to say something. So he says something. But he's not going to do anything. He's not a say-do guy. He's just anything to blunt and postpone the issue, take it off the front pages a little bit, divert the press. Oh, there might be a campaign finance commission he might appoint, or we'll look into it later. Anything to push it off before the election day occurs. And one thing after another illustrates the kind of person he is. On his knees before the corporations, trampling the rights of people who may conflict with what corporations want to order for our country. On the Crooks and Swindlers Act, a perfect illustration, Amy, a year ago, he very reluctantly vetoed it, giving a wink to Chris Dodd, Senator Dodd, who's the head of the Democratic National Committee, to rustle up the votes in the Senate and the House and override his veto, which Dodd did. Then Clinton goes out to Silicon Valley, meets with some of the billionaires, gets his usual campaign contributions, the mother's milk of the Clinton administration, and he rushes to the press right from the room where he met with the Silicon executives and announces he's against Proposition 211, which is designed to put a little law and order to the crooks and swindlers who take away and loot elderly savings retirement funds because of stock speculation, all the rest. And he gave legitimacy to the opposition to 211. And guess what? The Silicon Valley giants are putting ads now all over California for weeks saying Bob Dole and Bill Clinton don't agree on very much, but they both agree that 211 is bad. That's the kind of guy he is.
Ralph Nader, when we spoke to you towards the beginning of your campaign, you said that your hope was that this campaign would not be so much about electing you as president, which you obviously wouldn't have a chance to do if you couldn't get on the ballots in all 50 states to start with, but to seeing if you could have surface a movement that would be built and energized through your campaign. Could you talk for a minute about whether or not you think that's happened, and if so, where you see it having happened?
Well, it is happening. We'd like to have it happen in more states, but in the states where I am on the ballot, Connecticut, Rhode Island, they're moving toward ballot status for the Green Party. Some remarkably energetic people have surfaced, which is what we all expected would happen if people had an option for a progressive political movement apart from the tired, tawdry, and seamy the two-party duopoly of Republicans and Democrats. In New Mexico, they're fielding candidates in several offices, including for the U.S. Senate. A few years ago, they actually got 10% for the gubernatorial candidate. In California, they're bringing in more young people. That's an excellent sign. Washington State, where I was, the word of mouth is really pretty electric, and the lawn signs, and they're trying to mobilize and get their parties on the ballot. And the press is being treated to more corporate power issues. The whole issues of corporate crime and corporate welfare and GATT and NAFTA, these are being discussed. And C-SPAN is playing my addresses three, four times, one at Stanford most recently in California. So it's moving in the right direction. I couldn't imagine a 1996 presidential campaign where you had a libertarian and a natural law party and Howard Phillips' taxpayer party, but there was no progressive dimension to the campaign. The big mistake I think the Dole people made was they didn't have an independent expenditure on behalf of candidates who could take votes away from Clinton. They really had a very poor strategy on the part of the Doleites.
What's going to make it possible, however, for this movement, which you see as building, to exist after November 5th, in some way different than, say, Ross Perot's movement, which he started in 1992, and, you know, kept saying, it's not about me, it's not about me, it's not about me, but until he ran for president again, there really was no Reform Party. What do you see is going to be necessary November 6th onward for the Green Party that you've helped energize this time to remain a factor in American politics?
Well, that the people who have taken it this far in the states where the Green Party is operating, say in Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Jersey, New York, to get together right after the election, to begin determining the shape of the agenda in 98, who's going to run, who's going to do what tasks, and get very serious about it. They've got to avoid certain rhetorical bickering over certain slivers of the platform. They've got to get over that, get the consensus, and then go out and do the hard work of organizing, because Dodd is up in 98. This is a good test case to take a major slice of votes away from him and start this margin of victory or defeat presence of the Green Party. I mean, that's the first stage of a third party, is to begin determining the margin of victory and defeat for the Democratic candidates on the ballot. Before I went into Connecticut for 2 days of campaigning, the poll had me at 7%. So, you know, most races are decided by less than 7%. Clinton's going to win in a landslide, probably, in the eastern states and some other states. So why should people throw away their vote, even if they think Clinton is the least of the worst compared to Dole?
Ralph
why
Nader,
throw away your vote?
What about the states you're not on the ballot? Do you encourage people to write in your name?
Yes, I'm on the official write-in status in all other states except about five. That means that the authorities have to count the write-ins. And so in places like Virginia, Massachusetts, and elsewhere, I'm in official write-in status.
How much have you spent on your campaign so far?
Just less than $5,000. Isn't that amazing?
We have some people who called in, listeners who were angry, saying that you haven't shown political savvy and you haven't aggressively campaigned, and that's why they weren't going to vote for you. What do you say to those people who feel that your heart wasn't in it?
Well, I've done huge amounts of free media and day after day in recent weeks. If you don't take any campaign contributions, you don't have ads. If you don't have ads, a lot of people who don't listen to serious radio or rarely serious television don't see or hear me on these programs. But I have been on a lot of programs, Wisconsin, Minnesota. I mean, they're just on and on and on. I can hardly keep up with it. Also, you remember, I've been going around the country hundreds of times for 35 years or so. Isn't it people don't know where I stand? They just have to ask themselves, what do they want their vote to convey? If they want their vote to convey a wake-up call, a jolt to the Democrats, and at the same time help build the progressive political force, they're free to go to the polls and vote. Nobody's hiding my placement on the ballot.
Ralph, I have to ask you a quick question about airbags, since it's a battle you have waged for more than two decades. What's your reaction to all the information on kids being actually hurt by airbags?
Well, number one, the auto companies knew about that. They could have built the kind of airbags, and they knew how to, that would detect an out-of-position child parents never to put a child in the front seat, whether it has an airbag or not. In Sweden, for decades, parents have always put their children in the back seat, and that's where they should be, regardless of the airbag. Now, there will be forthcoming calibrated airbags and infrared detecting airbags that will solve the problem.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us again, Ralph Nader, who heads off to Colorado right now. And we'll see what happens on Election Day. We hope to speak to you on Election Night or the following morning.
Well, thank you, Amy and Larry. Bring them to the polls, folks. Everybody can bring a few neighbors and friends. And after Election Day, maybe the Democrats will realize that the days of holding voters hostage and telling them they have nowhere to go because the Democrats aren't quite as bad as Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole will be over.
Have the Democrats approached you recently in the last few days?
Not in the last few days, but up until late July, Clinton was indirectly and directly trying to persuade people who know me to get me to withdraw, which illustrates the importance of a third party that determines the margin of victory or defeat in future elections.
Ralph Nader, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Ralph Nader, Green Party presidential candidate. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back to talk about Texas, and then we'll look at redistricted areas throughout the country and look at what those races, the impact they are having on African-American candidates. Stay with us. Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington. Larry Bensky joins us from our Texas station, KPFT. We're going to talk about Texas right now. The fate of Congress in this election year could be in the hands of Texas voters, since some of the races there may not be finally decided on Election Day. Because of a Supreme Court ruling on the racial composition of voting districts, Texas has had to reshape its electoral map, which could lead to runoff elections later this year. Larry?
Yes, Amy, that's true. And here to discuss that phenomenon as well as Texas politics in general, we have an excellent panel of experts who've woken up early to come into our KPFT Houston studios. Welcome once again to Pacifica's microphones to Kathleen Knight, who is an associate professor of political science here at the University of Houston. She has a specialization in political psychology and electoral behavior. Robert Newberry is a local journalist with more than 30 years of experience in reporting. Up until fairly recently, he was editor of the Houston Reader. Before that, he was an editorial writer and columnist at the Houston Post. And we have Tim Fleck, who's a reporter for the alternative paper here in Houston, the weekly that is part of the New Times empire, the Houston Press. Welcome, all of you, to Pacifica Radio once again. Kathleen, let's start with you, if we could. Before we get to the congressional races, which we really want to talk about, let's for a moment dwell on the presidential level here. Texas seems like it's going to be an exception to President Clinton's seeming upcoming landslide around the country. They're even talking about him carrying states in the South, which no Democrat has carried for a long, long time, and states like Arizona. But here in Texas, including this morning in the Houston Chronicle in a poll, it looks like Bob Dole is still going to win. Why is Texas so Republican and resisting this Clinton mini wave?
I think it's Republican in part because it's new Republican. It hasn't been Republican so long that it can become tired of it. There's been a great deal of conservatism in Texas, and that was manifest in a conservative Democratic vote. So I think that coming on board as Republicans has caused people to look a little bit more seriously at Dole.
So, in other words, the politics have remained the same, only the label has changed.
Right.
Robert Newberry, what's your take on that?
I agree 100% is that Texas has long been Democrat, but it was really a closet Republican state because they couldn't get elected as Republicans. And once they began to elect Republicans in Texas, people really came out of the closet and voted the way they were thinking in the first place.
Jim Fleck?
Well, I'd take issue a little bit because the polls over the last 2 weeks have shown Clinton clearly within striking distance, certainly within the statistical margin to possibly take the state. I understood George Stephanopoulos was in Austin over the last 3 days talking seriously about trying to arrange a last-minute media buy because some people believe that in the Democratic circles that there's a chance Clinton will still take Texas by a very narrow margin.
But does that change what Kathleen and Robert have said about the essential conservatism and republicanism of the state?
No, but it does indicate Clinton's strength that we could even be talking about a possible Clinton narrow-edging victory.
As I've talked to Republicans down here over the years, they have jumped up and down in fury at the fact that they believe that the state has turned more Republican as far as the party is concerned, but that was not reflected in the congressional delegation because Democrats had gerrymandered the state in such a way that they continued to hold an advantage. Now we have a new element, which is the federal court's rulings about redistricting lines. As Amy said, we may have just a primary here in November and a runoff in December. What about all that? Isn't that just really justice, in fact, for the Republican presence in the state that they would be able to get more seats, Robert?
I don't think it's justice. I think it's
well, let's say fair rather than justice.
Republican justice.
Right. I think we need the district lines drawn about the way they were drawn in the first place because we really don't get the type of representation that we should. And I think this allowed Democrats, Sheila Jackson Lee and Ken Benson, to win some races and not have the state entirely like the district that is presided over by Steve Stockman.
Or Tom DeLay.
Our time delay, exactly, because we would be pretty much that if we didn't have these lines drawn the way they are.
But isn't that, to take the devil's advocate position here, isn't that fair if the state is in fact so heavily conservative and heavily Republican, Kathleen?
Oh, it might be fair in a balancing sense. I'm not quite as sure it's going to happen. The thing about these congressional races is that there are a number of individuals running. And there could be some surprises. Possibly the Democrats could pick up one more seat rather than having it go Republican.
Well, the joke of this redistricting is that the districts that were under challenge, 18, the inner city African-American district, and 29, which was designed initially for a Hispanic but is held by an Anglo, Gene Green, are not the districts that are impinged by or are impacted by this redistricting order. Those will stay the same. Green and Sheila Jackson Lee, the incumbents, are well ahead and are going to win. The redistricting, though, changes the mechanics for District 25 with Ken Benson, a Democratic incumbent, and throws the door wide open in 9, I believe, with Steve Stockman. So, in a sense, the redistricting doesn't even impact the districts that were challenged. It impacts the districts outside of that.
And as I arrived here last night, I stumbled across a Democratic Party fundraiser, and I spoke to a number of people there who said, well, this is just pure partisan politics.
It was a Republican panel of federal
Republican
judges.
Republican panel of federal judges led by Edith Jones, who at one point was considered for the Supreme Court by the Bush administration, and they found she was too conservative to get confirmed by the Senate. Well, she headed this redistricting panel.
And Melinda Harmon, who's on that redistricting panel, her husband is Frank Harmon, who heads an influential downtown Republican judicial PAC.
I would agree with Tim that this is not going to impact those districts that much. However, I just think it's a moral thing of what they're trying to do and what could occur. And I just don't think it's right because you're going to have people who will not be represented as it And I think that's the problem, and that's the travesty of it.
One thing that shows what mischief it was the district we mentioned here, Steve Sockman's district, where they really changed, what was it, 800 households were added to the district, and yet they said they have to have a whole new election.
Yeah. Almost nothing.
Almost nothing. In other words, they messed with the dynamics of that race, and now there's a possibility it might go into a runoff, and Stockman might win the runoff.
Right, because they injected a Democrat into what would have been simply an up or down Stockman-Lampson race.
Kathleen, let me ask you a question about the race that the rest of the country is focusing on, and many of our listeners are aware of, the photogenic man in the pickup truck. Running against the man who said, I have the best friend you can have in politics, a lot of money, Phil Graham versus Victor Morales. Latest information that I've seen and talked to people around here is, well, Morales fought a really good fight, but there's no way a guy like that could win. What's your take on it?
At this point, I don't think that there's a way that he can win.
Why?
Money.
So Phil Graham was right?
Graham is entirely correct, and he will be plastering the airwaves over the next few days in the radio markets with commercials. Morales, even though he has been saving his money to come in at the last minute, won't have enough to overcome it.
So it is a massive media state for people. We know it's a massive state, and there are, what, five or six television markets you really have to buy to reach a concentration of people.
That's right. At the Senate level, you have a very expensive race.
Robert, what's your take on the Morales race?
As much as I would like to see Morales win this, I don't think he will. And unless Clinton scores a win here, I think Morales would have a chance.
Well, everybody's always saying, why don't we have more of typical Americans in politics? Here's a guy who's a high school teacher, basically a social sciences mm-hmm. and physical education teacher. His slogan, ¿por qué no? And why not? Man emerging out of the population, working class guy. Here he's running for office, and you're saying it's money that determines whether or not he can win.
Well, ¿por qué no goes so far? ¿Por qué is also a question. and the question is, what's the issue that Victor Morales is pushing? And other than being Mr. Everyman, I don't think he's really energized anybody with, what am I for? What do we got to do?
Kathleen, what about that? Do you think Morales is losing on the fact that he hasn't had the right issues, or is it really about the dynamics of electoralism, the money part?
Well, I think even if he had a good issue campaign, and I believe Tim is right about that, he would still have a communication problem due to the lack of money.
And what do we do about that? Total campaign finance reform? Is there a movement for that in Texas? There is in other parts of the country. Do we detect any groundswell here that wants to reform the electoral system? From the silence of the three of them.
The flatness of it speaks for itself.
They talk about doing it a lot, but I don't think there's going to be very much done about it because, I mean, it's everybody knows where their bread is buttered, and they're going to continue to leave those doors open so they can continue to receive money. And I think what we need to do is put a cap on how much everybody can spend.
Well, what's interesting is that Victor came screaming in from outside the framework of the Democratic Party, knocked off some well-regarded Democratic politicos in the primary, and I think the party has still been kind of lukewarm with him, even though he is the party's nominee, and I think that's been a big problem for him, that he's been chill to them, they've been chill to him, and that's part of the money problem, is the Democrats didn't get behind him with promised money, national money.
We're talking with Tim Fleck. And as well as Kathleen Knight and Robert Newberry here in the studios of KPFT Houston about the upcoming election next Tuesday, where President Clinton is arriving in Texas tonight. He's going to be in El Paso tonight. He's going to be in San Antonio tomorrow morning. Victor Morales is going to appear with him there. I hope to be there as well and perhaps bring some report on that to this program on Monday. Talk for a second, if you would, about what people are talking about in the United States, which is the coattails, the reverse coattails of President Clinton. Is that helping or hurting candidates in Texas, for example, in close congressional races? Is there any way for you to say? The fact that he's a relatively unpopular person here in Texas. Ms. Jameson?
If he increases turnout, it could be beneficial. But what appears to be happening is a situation where an increasing number of people will sit out the race. So I expect that unless he does a great deal of last-minute campaigning here, a good number of Democrats will just sit back.
Why would they do that?
they're not that happy with him, and I don't think that... I think in part it's a matter of the women's vote as well. The Republicans have been fairly successful at chipping away at the character issues, and I think there are, in a way, there's so many things for women to do otherwise that they might just not go to the polls on Tuesday.
I think the Democrats will get out to vote. I think they see that Clinton is within striking distance here, that the undecided vote could put Clinton in the lead. And I think the Democrats are going to get out there and try to score a win for Clinton.
But you have an unusual phenomenon here in Texas, which is it's one of the states where you have the straight ticket vote. In other words, you just go in and mm-hmm. either punch a ballot or pull down a lever, and it's all Democrat, all Republican.
And that's why I think if Clinton gets a good turnout here and a win, that Victor Morales has a shot at it.
Except that in the districts that are being re-voted on, the right. ones
you
that...
You can't do a straight ticket.
Yeah, what's that all about?
Well, it takes away the straight ballot or straight ticket phenomena for a lot of the area here. So it's going to be different. Everyone's going to have to go down the ballot and actually look at it rather than just do your punch.
And I talked to Sheila Jackson Lee last night, who's one of the people whose district has been affected, and she said that she's encountered massive confusion on the part of voters who can mm-hmm. no longer vote a straight ticket. They're going to be handed three different pieces of paper. And she hinted that she thinks this is part of the Republicans' plan to depress Democratic
sure,
vote.
That's one of the things that they've been trying to do for years. They've been trying to get the straight ticket balloting outlawed here in Texas. And it's a ploy that's working for them, and certainly in some areas because we have so many Republicans here. I think we're going to get to the point where we will be voting straight tickets again.
But it's going to cut in the opposite direction this time, too, because the leading early ballot operation here is by conservative Christian rightists. Now, when these complicated ballots go out to all these nursing homes and elderly suburbanites, it's going to be as complicated for them as it is for Democrats in Sheila Jackson Lee's district. And so it's going to impact the Republicans negatively as well as the Democrats.
You have something else here in Texas which I think our listeners nationwide may not be aware of, and that is early voting. I believe it ended yesterday or today or something like that. Could you talk for a second, Kathleen Knight, about that? Where is that coming from, and is that really an improvement in the electoral system?
It could well be an improvement in the electoral system. We have an early voting period and no-fault absentee voting period that lasts 3 weeks prior to the election, and I believe ends today. That allows get-out-the-vote drives and busing people to Kmart for the opportunity to vote.
But that vote isn't tabulated until
election. It hasn't been organized, and of course it will be tabulated first, but not until after the polls.
So if I were a Texas voter today, I could go wherever I could find a voting booth and actually vote today instead of next Tuesday. Well, that seems to me a positive phenomenon. Is that has that had any effect on results in the state? You think it's had any effect on who wins? No?
I think the point of concern here are these early ballot applications that go out by mail, because certain political machines in certain part of the city have taken to getting elderly people, just line them up, sign them, get those ballots, wait for them to come back in the mail, and literally march these people through these ballots and get them to vote. And it's been demonstrated that's going on with some political machines, both liberal Democrat and conservative Christian.
Finally, as we look at the state of Texas, I at least remember this election year, that extraordinary Texas Republican convention some months back where the Christian right, as they have in many states, had dominance. They almost didn't allow Kay Bailey Hutchinson to be a delegate to San Diego. All the controversies here about school textbooks and other matters. Could each of you assess the role of the Christian right this time in the 1996 election? Is it growing, stabilized, declining? What can we say, Kathleen Knight?
The Christian right may be at its best organized point so far. I don't think that that means that they will get a significant increment, greater power as a result of that. But I think that they will maximize any possibility of a vote.
I think they have great organization for a few people, just a few. Great organization is what's driving it, and they are able to get out the vote, and they have a loud voice. And I think that's basically what they are.
Well, I think the telltale sign here is that the person who's running the mainstream Republican get-out-the-vote campaign is a man named Dr. Stephen Hotze, who for the last 20 years has been an extreme right, anti-gay rights, anti-abortion organizer. For him to be the mainstream organizer of the Republican Party here, the party of George Bush, the party of George Bush, the governor, just says something.
Not to mention Abraham Lincoln.
Well, I think they forgot about him a long time ago.
I want to thank the three of you for joining us this morning. You've heard most recently from Tim Fleck, who's a reporter for the Alternative Weekly here in Houston, the Houston Press. Also from Robert Newberry, a veteran journalist and former editor of the Houston Reader. And Kathleen Knight, who's an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston. Thanks also to Emma Burchill, who produced this segment for us this morning. I'm Larry Bensky. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington. Larry Bensky is with us at KPFT, our sister station in Houston, Texas. And we've just been talking about the Texas races, but we thought we would now expand that. We know that there are a number of districts that are redistricted in Texas, 13 to be exact. Well, there are districts in Georgia, Florida, and Louisiana as well that are being fought out right now that have been redistricted. And we're joined now by Penda Hare, who is the director of the Washington office of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, who has been dealing with this issue for quite a few years now. But can you tell us how it all started? What was the first challenge on the issue of redistricting?
Yes, what happened was in 1993, the United States Supreme Court created a new constitutional right for white voters who live in minority opportunity districts created under the Voting Rights Act to challenge those districts because they are, quote, bizarre. And as a result of that, the floodgates were open to all sorts of people, even people who didn't live in the districts at first, brought these cases in all across the South and in other places like Illinois and New York. And eventually, from 1993 to 1996, a lot of the cases were tried, and most of them were lost, and the districts were either found unconstitutional or redrawn in settlements.
Is there a common force behind the challenges to these districts?
Well, I think the common force is really an attack on the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was passed by Congress and amended in 1982 to allow African Americans and other voters who suffer from racially polarized voting, who can't attract white votes no matter how strong their candidates, to be able to elect candidates that would represent their interests. And so when the 1990s round of redistricting occurred, African Americans and Latinos in places like Texas were able to go into the political process and through the political process obtain districts where they were in the majority for the first time.
We just heard the discussion in Texas about redistricting, and the point there actually was this is about, you know, Republican versus Democrat. Do you find actually overall this is about keeping African Americans and Latinos out of Congress, or that it's about keeping Democrats out?
Well, I think it's both. And what happened in Texas, I think, is very illustrative. The African Americans and Latinos in Texas are Democrats, overwhelmingly Democrats. And so when they created the new districts, they tried to work with the Democratic Party so that surrounding white Democratic incumbents would not be hurt. When you create a new district, you always take away territory from somebody else. And as a result, in order to protect both the white incumbents and to create new opportunity districts, the districts look funny. You had to make them look funny in order to pull in enough Democrats to hold all those districts to be Democratic districts. So there was a lot of partisan politics that went into the redistricting as well as the Voting Rights Act. And what happened in court in Texas is that the federal court said that race was the predominant factor in the creation of three minority opportunity districts. I tried that case. I was down in Houston in 1994, and we strongly disagreed and felt that we put on a very good record, that it was politics, that you couldn't separate out the partisan politics. And we showed in trial that there could have been nice-looking African-American and Hispanic districts created, and the reason they look funny was not because of race. It was because of the partisan politics in the surrounding districts. The Supreme Court ended up saying, well, even if partisan politics played a part, race played too much of a part, and the districts were redrawn in 1996, and that's what was referred to in the prior segment, the 13 districts, three of which were minority opportunity districts.
I have a hard time understanding the rationalization of Sandra Day O'Connor in this case. I have a hard time understanding Sandra Day O'Connor, period. But in this case, especially on the Supreme Court, that, as you say, if it's about race, it's no good. If it's about preserving incumbents, it's good. Where in the Constitution or anywhere else does it say that preservation of an incumbency is an okay characteristic, but race isn't?
Well, I agree with you, and having argued this case in the Supreme Court and reading the decision and reading the dissent, we feel that the dissent had the better of the analysis. I think what Justice O'Connor was saying and what we said is that the Constitution does not prohibit partisan gerrymandering. It goes on all the time, and Texas may be the most egregious example of that, but it's not a constitutional violation. And what we showed in the Texas case is that majority white districts look at equally fun and, in fact, more bizarrely shaped than the minority opportunity districts, but the Supreme Court and the three-judge court down there thought that was okay, that wasn't unconstitutional. It's only when it's African-Americans that are using the process to get a district that will represent their interests that all of a sudden you have this constitutional doctrine that thwarts their political participation.
We're talking to Penda Hare, director of the Washington Office of NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. And we want to talk about some of the specific races right now. Three in Texas, we know, minority opportunity districts. One in Louisiana, two in Georgia, one in Florida. Corinne Brown is now battling to keep her seat in a new district. But let's go to Georgia for a minute. One of the races is the race of Cynthia McKinney, who was redistricted out of a majority African-American district into a majority white district. And before we ask you about it and what are her chances right now, we wanted to play the closing comments of Cynthia McKinney, the Democrat, versus John Mitnick, who is the Republican who is challenging her in a recent debate in Georgia.
Well, I think as you've seen tonight, Congresswoman McKinney's voting record is, frankly, left-wing and radical. She voted for the largest tax increase in history in 1993. In fact, her vote was the deciding vote, and she danced on the floor of the House in celebration of that vote, which also increased taxes on working senior citizens' Social Security checks. She voted three times against welfare reform that requires work, which is a bill that was ultimately signed by the president, and it doesn't matter whether he thought it was flawed or not. He signed it and is now the law of the land. Obviously, it was a good bill. She has refused to condemn the racism, anti-Semitism, and anti-Catholicism of Louis Farrakhan. She has appeared with him and defended him on many different occasions. That is completely out of step with the people of the 4th District. She voted against the anti-stalking law, the anti-terrorism law, and truth in sentencing, all of which I would support. Once again, she supports criminals over victims. She has the worst record on small business issues in the United States Congress, according to the National Federation of Independent Business. The contrast between the candidates in the election in this election could not be more extreme. I hope that when November 5th rolls around, you will agree that I am the voice of reason that can best represent the 4th District of Georgia.
Thank you, Mr. Mitnick. And now, Cynthia McKinney. Thank you very much. Tonight we've learned that my opponent is cut from the same cloth as Newt Gingrich. My opponent is a wealthy corporate lawyer, and he is now flip-flopped on the issue of the minimum wage, following again Newt Gingrich. My opponent favors a new national sales tax collected every time you spend a dollar. We've also learned that my opponent favors abolishing the education department, in spite of the fact that it would cause tremendous hardship right here in the 4th District. Just what we need in Congress, another lawyer, another vote for Newt Gingrich, another vote against workers, against women, and against education. In spite of the harsh attacks of my opponent, I stand before you as someone you can trust to make good decisions about the future. Remember, I voted for the crime bill, for a small increase in the minimum wage, and I helped stop Newt Gingrich and the extremists who tried to cut Medicare to give a tax break to the wealthy. If you share my vision for a better Georgia, please vote for me on November 5th. Thank you.
And that was Cynthia McKinney, the Democrat running in a news district, the 4th District in Georgia, against her Republican opponent, John Mitnick. Can you talk about that race and where Cynthia McKinney stands right now, pen to hair?
Well, I understand that the race is very close, too close to call at this point. Cynthia McKinney surprised a lot of pundits by winning that primary. Her district in redistricting was reduced from around 60% African-American voting age percentage down to 30. And her district is a district where African-American participation has historically been suppressed. It is a rural district. I've litigated voter registration cases in that area. And what you find is very poor African-Americans who were told to drive all over the county just to get registered to vote. When they would get there, all of a sudden the office would be closed. And that was in the 1980s. So it's been a hard road for her to get to the point where those African-American voters in that poor district are coming to the polls. And she did that. She got them registered, and she really worked to get the turnout so that she won the primary in a 30% African-American district without a runoff. When I heard those closing statements, I mean, it struck me that they were really partisan statements. You heard on the one side the typical Republican argument this time for all districts, and you heard Cynthia McKinney coming back with the traditional Democratic argument. This is a Democratic district. If race weren't involved, if there weren't racially polarized voting, she would win. The question is, are those white Democrats going to sacrifice their party because they don't want to vote for a black person? And that's racially polarized voting, and that's why the Voting Rights Act allowed states to create districts that had a higher African-American population before the Supreme Court started coming in and cutting it back down.
Of course, she probably would have had a better chance had her father, Billy McKinney, who's a veteran Georgia state legislator, not called Cynthia McKinney's opponent a racist Jew.
That was definitely an unfortunate aspect of her campaign.
Let me ask you this question, Appenda Hare. As we look around the country this time, there's a possibility that African Americans will not lose any seats in Congress, may even stay the same or add one. Cleo Fields decided not to run in Louisiana, but we have Ms. Carson, who may win in Indianapolis. Latinos may pick up another seat if Loretta Sanchez manages to defeat Bob Dornan in California. So the effects so far are not dire. And that's what, you know, I can see the George Wills of the world writing op-ed pieces about. What's your response to them when they say, well, look, it hasn't worked out that badly. It wasn't a wipeout of African-American and Latino representation.
I would agree that it's not a wipeout yet. What I'm concerned about is when these incumbents start retiring. What we're seeing now is that Cynthia McKinney had 4 years in office with the advantage of the Voting Rights Act to show her, to prove herself to white voters. And we're seeing in the newspaper reports that she has won over some white voters because of her constituency services, and because when you have an African-American person who is able to get elected, then you start overcoming those racial stereotypes. So if Cynthia McKinney wins, it will be because the Voting Rights Act gave her that power of incumbency. And the question is, would that carry over so that a non-incumbent would have a fair chance to get elected in Georgia? The second concern I have is, as this is only the first round of cases. We have about 6 districts that have been changed so far, but we have 2 more to be redistricted in North Carolina. We have a number of cases still pending. The floodgates are still open. We're going to see challenges to state legislatures, to city councils. Those cases are all going to have to be fought and litigated, and even if you lose, you know, you still try to preserve it at 40%. It takes a lot of resources to protect African-American voting rights in this climate.
What about Corinne Brown, who is running in Florida. What are her chances right now?
I think her chances are about the same as Sheila Jackson Lee and Eddie Bernice Johnson in Texas. In those cases, even though there was a setback and the districts were changed, the African-American population was able to be maintained at around 40%. And because, again, of the power of incumbency, it looks like that those three candidates may squeak through with the new districts. But again, it's they are incumbents, and they've had years in office to show that they can overcome the stereotypes.
And Georgia's second congressional, Larry, just one sec on the last one, Georgia's second congressional district, Sanford Bishop.
I think it's the same thing. His district, again, also came down into the 30s, but he's an incumbent, and I'm not a pollster, but I understand he's looking pretty good, so I hope that he's able to pull it out as well as Cynthia McKinney.
What is your analysis of what's going to happen in 4 years when we have the reapportionment that's based on the census, and states like New York and Pennsylvania and other Northeast states are going to lose two or three members of Congress each, and states like Georgia and Arizona are going to gain members? What is the impact of that going to be on, as you'd call it, opportunity districts where African Americans and Latinos run?
I think it's going to be a really tough political fight, and it depends in part on what happens in the Supreme Court. I think the Supreme Court doctrine in this area right now is very unstable. All the decisions are 5-4, and it's not just 5-4. It's very divided, and you have dissenters saying if there's a change in this court, we're going to change this law because we don't think that this is a proper interpretation of the Constitution, and we think it strays so far from the proper interpretation of the Constitution that we wouldn't apply the normal rule that says that you give respect to prior decisions. So it is a very divided court on this issue, and because the doctrine is not stable, it may be that we can in the future see a court that will return to the law as it was before 1993 or something closer to that.
Cynthia McKinney, I had pen to hair. I was just going to ask you about Cynthia McKinney. What about looking back now, back to 1993, when the challenge first happened? Do you think people should have adopted a different strategy in dealing with this? I was thinking about Cynthia McKinney, who was one of the first to be challenged. And I think she felt a great deal of resentment that the Congressional Black Caucus hadn't immediately mobilized. And then everything came down after that. And she said, this is exactly what I had predicted. What about the strategy that was adopted?
Well, let me say that in terms of the private civil rights bar, we certainly mobilized, and we went and got in every single case. My office was in the Georgia case, in the Louisiana case, in the Texas case, in the North Carolina case. So there was good legal representation in those cases, and I think Cynthia McKinney was happy with that. I think there was some concern that there wasn't enough public outrage being expressed by the members of the Congressional Black Caucus. I think it took a long time for the Congressional Black Caucus to understand this just didn't apply to new seats or to new members of Congress, that this is something that was a threat to the entire Congressional Black Caucus. Once this ball starts rolling, it could roll right over into 40 districts and not just the few that are challenged so far.
But do you think public outrage would have changed anything?
Well, I mean, I don't know how much the Supreme Court goes by what's on the front pages of the newspapers, but my belief is always that you need to have both. You need to have a public education and statements of public concern, and you need to have top quality litigation in the court system, and the two working together produce the best outcomes in terms of constitutional decisions.
But one thing we should remember is that the Supreme Court itself, I wouldn't call it unstable, but it is subject to occasional change. And if, as looks likely, President Clinton wins re-election and the Senate stays in Republican hands, it's going to be very difficult for him to get any kind of progressive or even liberal justice confirmed by a Judiciary Committee headed by Orrin Hatch and a Senate that's led by Trent Lott, should there be vacancies on the Supreme Court in the next 4 years.
Well, I hope that should the Republicans control the Senate when judicial nominations go through in the next Congress, I hope they'll apply the same standard that they expected the Democrats to apply when Clarence Thomas was nominated, because there were no ideological tests when Clarence Thomas was, and other Reagan-Bush appointees sailed through a Democratic-controlled Senate.
I want to thank you very much for joining us, Penda Hare, head of the Washington office of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund.
Thank you.
on Monday, if you can hear those words there, promises, promises. We're going to be taking a look at President Clinton's campaign promises in 1992, and we'll be comparing them to his record, speaking with grassroots groups around the country on various issues. I want to thank Larry Bensky, who's joined us from Texas, from our sister station KPFT in Texas. I'm Amy Goodman.
I'd like to thank a couple of people here. Amy, Eric Truax, who's engineered for us today, and Bob Sham, who gave us technical assistance, and Emma Burchill, who produced our segments from Texas.
And we want to thank here Kenneth Mason, our engineer, Julie Drizin, our producer. And if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. We welcome your comments on the comment line. You can call 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. And we had some calls on whether Ralph Nader is on various state ballots. You can call the Nader campaign at 1-888-NADER-96. That's 1-888-NADER-96. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!